Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 7th, 2011, and I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. While many people's attention was grabbed last Sunday night by the announcement of the death of Osama bin Laden, there were two other things going on of much more significance for the future of our nation and of human civilization, but which have largely unfolded outside of any media coverage. The first is the intensifying mobilization of LaRouche PAC to pass House Bill 1489 to restore the Glass-Steagall Bill, which was a central feature of Franklin Roosevelt's anti-depression policy. The second was LaRouche PAC's coverage of a report on a new social contract by an official government, German government advisory group headed by a phony scientist named Schellenhuber, which Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche have denounced as an expression, as expressing an implicitly genocidal intent, which goes so far towards imposing a global eco-fascist dictatorship that it would make Adolf Hitler blush. Thus, at the same time the president was basking Nero-style over the killing of bin Laden, he was meeting with Prince Charles, a complete crackpot, whose family is the sponsor of this genocidal plan. On the weekly report on LPAC TV this week, Mr. LaRouche spoke in the sharpest language that these imperial monetarist forces, along with their puppet President Obama, are going full tilt for this new global fascist order. He also emphasized that the best defense the American people have against this is the early passage of the Glass-Steagall Bill, H.R. 1489, which would put a stake through the heart of the London-centered vampires by bringing down their bankrupt financial empire. With me today to discuss this extraordinary strategic situation is Deborah Freeman, Mr. LaRouche's national spokeswoman, and someone who is directly in the middle of this fight. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And as you are quite familiar with this, I do have some email questions for you, but I'm going to start with a few of my own.
Okay.
And why don't we begin with an update on where things stand on the Glass-Steagall resolution?
Well, you know, it really is quite an interesting situation right now, and it's one that I have to stress really changes almost by the hour. The fact of the matter is that we're in a situation where the whole country is about to explode, and that's a result of several different factors. As I think most of our listeners know, it is a result very concretely of an ongoing and escalating financial collapse, mm-hmm. accompanied by an economic collapse. It's compounded by the fact that you have at the very best, incompetent and insane president. And, you know, if you're less of a generous person, a president who is an outright agent of a foreign power. That in and of itself created a situation which was explosive. But in a sense, something that worked very much in our favor, during the course of the congressional recess, you had an unexpected series of events in the form of these tornadoes that swept through the Midwest and the Southeast. The reason why I say that this, in a sense, worked in our favor is we came into the congressional recess with a lot of people supporting Glass-Steagall, a lot of people no longer able or willing to pay lip service to the fact that somehow there was a recovery just around the corner, and no longer willing to go along with Obama's insanity. But then, when these tornadoes hit, what were we faced with? Well, you had 49 of the 50 states already in a state of bankruptcy. You had state legislatures that went into the end of their sessions, in almost all cases, imposing really brutal austerity, but then finding themselves in a position where even with the brutal austerity, they could not make ends meet. Then these storms hit, and the result of that was that you have now, depending on who's doing the estimate, 8 states, in some cases 12 states, that are in absolute catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
Entire communities destroyed. The whole planting season, right down the drain. Now, interestingly, those states are not uniformly Democratic states. They're Democrats and Republicans that represent those states and those Americans. So by the time these guys got back to Washington, not only was Glass-Steagall on the table because LaRouche PAC put it on the table, but it came back onto the table in a very dynamic way and in a bipartisan way, because here you have a country in a state of disrepair, but you have now a collection of states, and these are not unimportant states, that are experiencing a catastrophe beyond belief, and there is nothing being made available to them. The president went there and said some stuff about, I don't know, you know, we'll, we're with you and we'll stand shoulder to shoulder with you, and that's all really nice. But outside of a certain amount of limited funds that are made available through FEMA, there's nothing forthcoming in the way of real aid, which the president can do. He has discretionary funds for precisely this reason.
Well, this is this is what Lyndon LaRouche has been referring to as the Haiti treatment, where Obama basically comes in and says, yes, we feel badly for you, and then his FEMA administrator says, sorry, it's the local governments that have to deal with this, as though they don't know that local governments are bankrupt. Are we getting some response then from the Congress on this, Debbie? People are just angry that, that they're being told there's no funds?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these guys came back to Washington, and for many of them, what was the, what would have been, were it not for other intervening factors, Sunday night, what they were telling us coming back to Washington was that the first thing on the agenda was going to be, how are we going to deal with this? Because they have no choice. Now, obviously, that takes the question of Glass-Steagall, and it really puts it center stage, because the argument, you know, the counter-argument that comes out of the White House is, well, guys, we'd really like to help you, but, you know, we can't really afford it. And how could they afford it when they're pumping trillions of dollars into Wall Street? But now, what have we been saying? What has LaRouche PAC, what have the candidates associated with the LaRouche movement, and what have thousands of citizens who are LaRouche supporters been telling their congressmen now for weeks? They've been saying, well, you know, you may on the one hand say that you don't have, that we don't have the money, but pass Glass-Steagall, and that frees up about $17 trillion in credit. Well, now, you know, you can definitely do something with that, don't you think? And that is really what has completely shaped the environment. However, I don't want to create too optimistic a picture.
Right.
Because, you know, as we talk to people, there are, by my count, about 35 Democrats and Republicans who have stated publicly in the last 2 weeks that they would support Glass-Steagall. Behind them, there are approximately another 85 Democrats and Republicans who have supported Glass-Steagall in the past and have indicated that they haven't changed their view. All of them say the same thing. They say, yes, I intend to sign on to the bill. But the bill has been on the table now for 2 weeks, and they haven't signed on to it yet. As it stands now, there are 5 co-sponsors of that bill.
Well, Debbie, let me ask you about this then, specifically on this point, because this is something that the listeners can do something about. There are two questions here. One, those who were told that the Dodd-Frank bill would eventually emerge as the regulatory power, so you don't need Glass-Steagall, were given a slap in the face this week when Geithner said, there'll be no need, no regulation at all for foreign exchange derivatives, which is about a $4 trillion a day trading operation. But secondly, the point that you've made and Mr. LaRouche has made is that the Obama administration is going to come down like a hammer on any Democrat who announces for Glass-Steagall. So with this being said, where's the potential to move this?
Well, that's what I was going to say, Harley. It's what we have to be clear on is that someone intending to sign on, even someone who does sign on, that is not sufficient, because this is an existential battle. And our enemies recognize that. They know that Glass-Steagall will mean the absolute end of their system. And therefore, with every day that passes, and this is something that I've repeated to a number of congressmen over the course of the last 24 to 48 hours, they say, I intend to sign on. But I know that the period of time in between when they say that and they actually do it is a period of time in which they will be brought under excruciating pressure. And therefore, they cannot waste any time. And what we have to be prepared to do, and you know, I mean, I know that many of our supporters who tune into the LaRouche show have called their congressmen, or they've seen their congressman at a town meeting or at a meeting that they've set up, and they get a positive response on Glass-Steagall, and then they're happy. And what I have to make clear to our supporters is that is not enough. Mm-hmm. Support is not enough. The question is, what are you going to do, right, Mr. Congressman? What are you going to do to guarantee that this passes? Now, I think also it's extremely important for people to look at this from the standpoint of what's going on in Europe. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, especially under conditions when, you know, things are terrible in the United States, when people are out of work and people are having, you know, to face foreclosures and all of the nightmares that we know our population is being subjected to. If you then come in and start talking to them about an operation that's being run in Europe, you know, people will very often look at you and say, look, you know, I'm sorry that that's happening, but we've got to take care of things here. We've got to deal with business here.
Right.
You know, I really can't worry about what's going on in Europe. And that is, in many cases, you know, you get, on the one hand, that response when you talk to people about the WBGU report.
Right.
Or what you get from others is they say, well, yes, I've looked at that, but, you know, that's really extreme. They're not going to, you know, that's just not going to happen. It's over the top. But you see, both those responses come from a complete lack of understanding of history.
Mm-hmm.
And a lack of understanding about the nature of the United States. Because if you look back at what happened in the 1930s and 40s, you know, our enemy may be insane, but they're not completely stupid. And they do know that there are some things that just will not fly in the U.S. I mean, this is a question that Mr. LaRouche has referred to repeatedly. It is the issue of American exceptionalism. Because believe me, if they could unleash John Holdren to do what he wants in the U.S., he would propose the exact same thing that Eric Schellenhuber is proposing. But they can't do that here. So what do? They do it in Europe. And I would recall for people precisely what did happen in the 1930s they would have loved to install Hitler in the United States. It wasn't possible. But if you look at the period of time from when Hitler first unveiled his Mein Kampf to what was it? But within 8 years, you had a nightmare in Germany and a world at war. And this is precisely what these guys are trying to do now, except now you're not looking at an 8-year perspective. You're looking at something which is very concentrated and very compact.
Yeah, it's coming down at this very moment. You're listening to Deborah Freeman, the national spokeswoman for Lyndon LaRouche. And Debbie, what you just brought up brings two questions to mind. To go back to this point with the Congress, and I do want to get your thoughts on the Schellnhuber report and the complete insanity of this in a few minutes, but to stick just for a couple more minutes on the Glass-Steagall question, you talk to a lot of congressmen, as you said, economists and other kinds of officials. Do they get the sense of urgency that you have, that Mr. LaRouche has, that
no.
we've reached the end? And that's sort of a rhetorical question. The other question then is, do they actually understand what we're up against, the nature of the enemy? And this gets back to the point you made about it, understanding the United States as a unique history.
No, they don't understand it. There are maybe two or three that understand the urgency of it from the standpoint that just because of the way things have happened over the course of the last couple of years, they do honestly see Wall Street as their enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really where it stops.
Uh-huh.
They don't have an in-depth understanding. And look, even the principal sponsor, Marcy Kaptur, look, she's a wonderful person, and she's polemicized against Wall Street for months. But she also had this bill ready to go for weeks.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was taking barometric pressure readings to see when was the best time to implement it. And it is the case that even to the degree that you have some members of Congress who, for instance, would look at the Schellnhuber report and recognize that this is a very bad and dangerous thing, what they do not understand, because they don't understand history and they don't understand economics. If anyone is serious about putting a stop to it, pass Glass-Steagall.
Mm-hmm.
Because the passage of Glass-Steagall in the United States would bring that dynamic in Europe to a screeching halt. And it would shut down the people who are behind the Schellnhuber report. It shuts down the British monarchy and all of their, you know, variously insane and evil plans. And the problem is that is not understood. If it was understood even a teeny little bit, then you would not get people telling you about what they intend to do.
Yeah.
They would have done it.
You know, we saw the spectacle of the British wedding, which I think was quite expensive, and then Prince Charles comes to the United States, and there was this photo opportunity with Obama, and you see Charles sitting there talking the way he usually does, hard to understand him, and Obama was sitting there in rapt attention, almost drooling, and it was so clear, if you think about it, the problem here. Now, the thing that I think is important about what you just said for the question of the urgency, we just had another lying report come out on unemployment, where they covered the real depth of the unemployment, covered that up by saying there were so many jobs created. There are some people in the Congress who know the desperation of people in their districts. I guess the question is, that's got to be made clear to the Congress by people visiting the offices and just raising hell, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, the unemployment figures were instructive, because in the morning, what did the headline say? The headline said 225,000
new jobs
have been created. And then in little tiny print, the fact that even though all these new jobs were created, and you later find out that they weren't created at all, they're a computer projection.
But the rate went up.
Yes, and it went up to 9,
yeah.
Which is, you know, those 0.2 of a percentage point in terms of the psychology of the nation are critical, because 9% unemployment is just unprecedented. And 225,000 not yet born part-time jobs flipping hamburgers doesn't address that. And by the, you know, by the Bureau of Labor Statistics' own information, the greatest loss of jobs overall and then in this last month continue to be in the manufacturing sector. So that, again, I mean, it pushes everything to the fore. But, you know, you have to, in a certain sense, understand that this guy Obama, if people act in a sane manner, every time this guy opens up his stupid clap mouth, it helps us. Because while he was, you know, traipsing around, doing whatever it was he was trying to do in Kentucky at this military base, before he did that, he stopped in Indiana,
right,
and one of the hardest hit states by unemployment. And what does he say? He says, well, our economy's resilient. We can take a few hits.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if you're there, you got three kids, you're out of work, they're foreclosing on your house, you listen to this and you want to reach out and strangle this guy. You can't take any more hits. Oh, we're resilient. We can take a few more hits. We'll bounce back, because the moron focuses on what's going on Wall Street. Yeah, Wall Street, they can bounce back. Why can they bounce back? Because we're going to give them another $1 trillion of your money, buddy.
And this is where you see the growing gap between the actual desperation of a large number of the traditional Democratic constituents, including labor, and I want to get to that in a moment, and the complete the president's complete blocking on that situation and lying about it. But prior to what happened last Sunday, it was clear that Obama was going down. He was facing a dramatic drop in the polls. The firefighters were attacking him. The teachers are starting to come out and attack him. And I think this little bump is going to be short-lived, but I think it would be a mistake just to ignore it.
Well, but you know, Harley, it really wasn't a bump at all. And this is one of the, you know, some of the people who I kind of have no choice but to, you know, rub shoulders with here in Washington are the people who do these polls.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that Tuesday morning, a site which is a very reliable site called the Daily Beast ran a headline that said Obama's numbers were flat following the raid in Pakistan, and this set off a complete panic,
mm-hmm,
in the White House, and they commissioned a whole series of new polls and.
Sure.
But, you know, the polls, and I've seen the language on the polls, the new round of polls, the polls that show Obama's ratings going up, you know, what they virtually are asking people is, if you had to choose between Barack Obama and Osama bin Laden, who do you choose?
Well, I also
who do you like better, Osama or Obama?
The very same polls, Debbie, were showing that his handling of the economy was at its lowest rating.
Mm-hmm. Well, because those questions were stuck in there.
Yeah.
But the jump that is being reported, which, you know, you can call it a dead cat bounce, but it's not even a bounce. Because the bottom line is that the way the questions were posed that way after the political team in the White House panicked, because here, and again, you know, let's go back for a moment. What we were discussing with Mr. LaRouche on Friday, because we were in touch with members of Congress, including people in the Democratic leadership, who previously were the ones who carried water for Obama, we were being told that when they came back on Monday, that it was going to be a complete explosion and that there was nothing that was going to keep a lid on it. And that was the situation. But then you had the raid.
Mm-hmm.
And it shifted things. But in the opinion of, you know, people who make a living doing this, and I have to say, I mean, it's my opinion as well, the change of subject,
mm-hmm,
is very short-lived. I mean, it lasted for about 72 hours. I think the only thing that prolonged it is that there was so much lying coming out of the White House.
Yeah.
You know, first, you know, Obama was using his 12-year-old wife as a human shield, and then Osama was using his 12-year-old wife as a human shield, and he was heavily armed, and it was a firefight. And then the next thing you hear is that wasn't true at all, and there was no firefight, and he was unarmed. And then, you know, somebody felt that that wasn't such a good story, so they say, well, I don't know, there was an AK-47 on the night table that he could have just reached out and used. I mean, this is just ridiculous. But it's also, you know, the real question, and it's the question that, you know, I put to people repeatedly. I don't really care whether somebody approves of this or not. The bottom line is the world any different today than it was a week ago before this occurred?
Well, Debbie, that's exactly what the candidates have been going out. The LaRouche candidates have been going out and saying to people, has your situation improved because of the killing of Osama bin Laden?
Yeah.
Did you get a job? Did you get your house back? Did your children get their teachers back? And it cuts through very quickly the feel-good sentiment that the media was trying to create.
Absolutely. And that really, and that is now reasserting itself. And it is the case, you know, and look, during the course of the last session, you know, during the healthcare fight and the first fight around Glass-Steagall, you had people in the Democratic leadership, people like Nancy Pelosi on the House side, and Harry Reid on the Senate side, who, you know, they were like kamikaze pilots in terms of carrying out the administration's wishes. But and that is in fact how Glass-Steagall was defeated during the last session. But you know, the situation that we saw during the budget fight was Obama, because of his severe psychological problems, because of his mental instability, combined with the orders that were coming out of, you know, out of London, behaved in a manner which was absolutely insane during the budget fight. He refused to talk to the Democrats.
Right.
The Democrats were out of the negotiations. The negotiations were all between Obama and his Republican counterparts. And we saw, and we continue to see, a real kind of Mutt and Jeff, hard cop, soft cop, counter-gang operation.
Isn't that where the whole issue of Medicare is now, where the administration...
Course.
Yeah. Why don't you just explain that a little bit, because there's some people... actually, I have a couple of questions. Someone wants you to explain how Glass-Steagall would bankrupt the British, but I'd like to, since you're bringing this other point up, Obama versus the traditional Democratic position on Medicare, and in fact, the policy that most Americans support is to keep your hands off Medicare. How is that fight shaping?
Well, you know, Harley, the one problem that, I mean, this is the problem that Bush had when he wanted to privatize Social Security. And it's a big problem that Obama has, is that if you look at every post-war policy that was implemented in the United States, if you look at every post-depression policy, the two programs in this country, well, actually there are three programs that have actually functioned. They've done exactly what they were intended to do, they've done it efficiently, and they've done it at low cost. Social Security, Medicare, and NASA.
Huh.
And those are the three things that Obama is looking to wipe out. And the way that this is orchestrated, and again, people have to just take a step back and look at what happened during the budget fight. They trotted out this Stepford wife, Paul Ryan. And yeah, I have to admit, I mean, you know, when you line all these guys up, it is really kind of freaky, because you have Paul Ryan, you have, you know, the governor of Florida, the governor of Wisconsin, and there's a few others you can throw into the mix, Cantor, They all look exactly the same.
Well, I just keep looking at these pictures where there's John Boehner with his orange face, and then seven or eight guys standing behind him that do look like cutouts of the same.
It's like watching that film Matrix. I mean, they were all produced in the same clone factory. I don't know. They really.
And then when they speak, they all say the same thing.
Yes, and they all buy their ties at the same store. It's absolutely frightening, but. They trot out Paul Ryan with his, weird blue contact lenses. And what does he say? He proposes a 5-year budget, which is deficit reduction.
$20 trillion reduction.
It's insane. It'll reduce the deficit. It'll reduce the existence of the United States. You won't have any people here to make a deficit. It was psychotic. But what it allowed, and this is what its intention was,
right.
It allowed Obama to then come out a few days later with a far more moderate proposal, which would basically give you a very clear result. And, this is one area where we really didn't even have to do the work on this. What any number of different think tanks in Washington came out with, and they said, look, if you take a close look at what the president is proposing on Medicare, this is not a reform of Medicare. This would be the end of Medicare. And that's the Obama plan, not even the Republicans have backed off from their plan because they were almost lynched during the recess.
Well, isn't this also why Democrats are now joining with Republicans against the Independent Payment Advisory Board?
Of course.
Yeah.
No, this is the point that I was getting at before.
Yeah.
Because of the way this game has been played between Obama and the Republicans, and with certain things coming after that. It's very interesting. When the vote on the budget came up in the House, almost all of the Democrats voted against the president's budget.
Right.
And that was with the full backing of Nancy Pelosi, who previously was, grinding people's testicles up to make pate, on other questions. But she was placed in an untenable situation. She could not support what Obama was doing. And furthermore, because of the particulars of his personality, he was extremely abusive to her.
Mm-hmm.
So that caused a very significant shift. And that is now playing into the current fight on Glass-Steagall, because it is not so clear that this president can depend on the House Democratic leadership to do his bidding. And that's one of the reasons why what you had going on in the week leading up to the recess and then in this past week is something which, I think is unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
You've had Geithner and Bernanke running around Capitol Hill like two lunatics, meeting with they're meeting with ranking members of subcommittees and taking them at wining and dining them as if they were the biggest power brokers in the world. Because they're hysterical. They are absolutely desperate. They have no clue how they are going to get away with the kind of swindle that is basically their program.
Well, that's what I want to come to next. I just want to make sure our listeners know you're listening to Deborah Freeman on The LaRouche Show, and I assure you, you're getting an inside view that you'll never get anywhere else. This program is going to be archived on the LaRouchePub.com site. And if you want to organize your friends and neighbors and coworkers and other people to go out and organize with you to get Glass-Steagall, get them to listen to this interview, because Debbie is giving you the inside report as you'd never get it anywhere, including to where Nancy Pelosi gets her pate. So I think this is important for people to get out and get this story out there. So Debbie, there are a couple of emails we've gotten, people who say, okay, Glass-Steagall, so that's what we need, but how would Glass-Steagall work? How would it stop the British Empire and the bailout?
Well, I mean, first of all, you have to dismiss what some people are coming up with as their fallback. Because what some people are saying is, well, why don't we compromise? Let's pass Glass-Steagall, but you know, you can't really make it retroactive. So let's say from this day forward, we'll separate, you know, commercial banking from brokerage, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, let's do it that way. But you see, what that does is that kind of leaves out. And, you know, I use this number because it seems to be the official number, but I have no idea if it's accurate. I mean, I'm not sure I know how to write it down. But you have about between 17 and 18 trillion, depending on whose numbers you're looking at.
Isn't that the figure from Borofsky, though, when he was on his way out? I think that's where that figure came from.
Well, he used, you know, I have two statements from Borofsky. First, he used 22 trillion. And then he said that that wasn't fair. He was exaggerating, so he lowered it to 18 trillion.
I think he partly lowered it because Bernanke and others were saying that some of it had been paid back.
Yeah, right.
They borrowed from another window to pay it back, the way General Motors did.
Exactly. You know, it's like Lindsay for, you know, I'll gladly pay you tomorrow for a hamburger today. You know, they took the money from the bailout, from the TARP bailout, and, you know, these bankers gladly paid it back. They did pay it back. They paid it back in return for, you know, for something which was three orders of magnitude greater.
Well, the TARP was $750 billion, and the off-TARP, or the off-budget, was the unlimited credit lines at 0% interest that were rolled over and over and over, and that's, I think, where Borofsky had the 17 to 24 trillion figure.
And look, it's, you know, the problem, and it's one of the reasons why I think, you know, Borofsky went back and forth, is that since the Fed is under no obligation to tell anybody what they're doing, you know, you can only estimate what these numbers are. I suspect you're talking about far greater sums.
Well, part of Glass-Steagall would be an audit then, right, to figure out how much bad debt is still on the books of these so-called too-big-to-fail banks.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, once you separate out accounts, and that really is what it comes down to, because an audit can take a very long time. If you just separate out accounts, there, you know, any account which is essentially a derivative corrupted account has no place in a protected bank.
In a depository institution.
Absolutely.
That, yeah.
So you just separate it out, and, you know, because in all honesty, Harley, an audit could take 2 years, and we don't have 2 years. Once you establish and determine your operating banks, and some of the banks, it's undoubtedly the case that even under bankruptcy protection, they're just not going to make it. But enough of our banking system can be salvaged, and you establish them under protection with new regulations.
Right.
By doing that, you're freeing up. And see, this is, I think, the real error that not so much an error, I think it causes confusion for people. People expect that somehow or other, you're going to then see some lump sum of money that's going to just be handed over.
Right.
And, you know, if someone carrying lots of suitcases full of big bills, that's not what happens. What happens is that you have, it's essentially restored to the credit account of the U.S. government.
That's right.
And under those circumstances, and, you know, people have to really think through these numbers. $17 trillion is an enormous amount of money. We talk about what are we going to do to deal with the bankruptcy of the states. You could immediately move with emergency funds to salvage critical programs in every state in the union, and you will not even put a dent in that $17 trillion. When we talk about things like restoring NASA, when we talk about things like building NOAAPA, the credit for these kinds of operations, and these are operations that have enormous payback into the economy, restoring not only the presence of various satellites and other instrumentation that would allow us to not only to record data, but to actually analyze data so that we could begin to address problems like the looming threats of seismic disasters along the Pacific coast.
Right.
That's what you use that $17 trillion for. And any minor difficulty that, you know, people detect now as baby boomers come of age and the Social Security fund is drained down, put people back to work and you immediately solve that problem. You don't even it's not even worth considering.
You see, that's also the solution on the states, because the state problem is the spending has gone up because of the collapse. But you've also lost revenue. And there's this ironic situation now in California where they're talking about the revenue going up this last month, and this is a good sign. And, of course, that's capital gains taxes on the stock bubble.
Right.
So it's not sustainable, as opposed to the kind of investment that LaRouche has been discussing with NOAAPA, where you're creating 7 million jobs that will be producing real wealth by moving earth and moving water, creating power, and so on. So I think a lot of this is, people can go to the website and get the details. We have a lot of excellent videos up there. There was a recent video that you did after the last webcast where you went through some of this. But I want to get back to, I think, what we've got to get across to our listeners, because we're getting some emails coming in. How are we going to do this? How is it going to function? And I think the question now, I'd like you to just state again, are we going to post the list of the 35 or 100 people? I'd heard we were probably going to do that somewhere on our website so people can know who to go to, who to target, who to put the pressure on. What's your thinking on how to do that, Debbie?
I'm not really, to be honest, I'm not inclined to put that list on the LaRouche PEC site.
Okay.
The list was made available internally, but, you know, really, I think it's a big mistake to narrow ourselves to those 35 expanded to 100 members of Congress.
Good.
For our supporters, everyone has a congressional representative. And at this point, don't worry about whether someone is a good target or not. I have to say, I've been pleasantly surprised in a number of instances to find people who I found myself talking to them just because I happened to be standing next to them, and really never imagined that person as someone who would seriously take up the idea of co-sponsoring a Glass-Steagall reenactment, responding positively. At the same time, you know, you have other people who, you know, various blogs and the press and others have made into somehow anti-Wall Street heroes, like this idiot. And I say unabashedly that he is an idiot, from your state, Ron Paul. People get upset about Ron Paul's son, who is simply the son of an idiot.
He's a chip off the old block.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Ron Paul is, because Ron Paul called for, you know, an audit of the Fed,
it's the Fed
and other
his
things.
His anti-Fed sentiment is what originally brought him to the attention of people.
Yeah.
He's an enemy of the American system because he's against credit.
But he's against credit. He is, when the Angelides report came out, which was an honest assessment, and then obviously followed up by the Levin report, Ron Paul was one of the first people to run to the microphone to attack the Angelides report. He's opposed to Glass-Steagall. And it's a, you know, it's interesting because a number of Republicans who were extremely sympathetic to Glass-Steagall say, well, you know, this is really not my area of expertise. I'm going to consult Ron Paul, because they wanted some cover, I think. But then they went to him, and what does he do? He lectures people on the Austrian school.
Right.
I mean, you know, the irony of it is that Ron Paul, when, you know, at the end of the day, is probably, you know, somebody who, in principle, you know, would find himself in agreement with Schellenhuber. It's really unbelievable.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, from the standpoint of any citizen, you go to your congressman, whoever he or she is, you go to your senator as well, and you make clear that this is really not negotiable. You don't want to know, don't call them up and ask them where they stand. You call them up and you tell them what you are insisting on and that you want an answer and you want a timetable. And, you know, there's no reason to be disrespectful if, you know, if somebody is civil to you. But you really do have to be very persistent and be very clear, because many of them will come back and say, oh, yes, I know all about this and I'm looking at it. That's not good enough. And even if they say, I intend to co-sponsor it or I have co-sponsored it, not good enough.
Right. What are you doing?
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
It's got to be done now.
Yeah.
And look, I, you know, on the one hand, people have to be clear. This is going to be a bloody fight, because it is an existential fight. This will mean, this is not just a question of providing jobs, of, you know, restoring state budgets. This really will bring to a grinding halt an entire epic of history that has been dominated by European oligarchs. It
right.
will bring it to a halt. It will reassert the dominance, not of, you know, the United States as some superpower, but it will absolutely reassert the principles and the ideas that allowed our country to develop and to develop as a model for other countries yet to be born. And it does it on a dime. And that is really what people have to understand. There are very few problems that we face that cannot be addressed with this really very simple and elegant solution. But it is also the case that, you know, it's not timeless, not only because of the you know, problem of the enemy responding, but it also, I mean, people have to be clear that if we don't move now, I mean, at this point, there are banks that, if placed under protection in a Glass-Steagall framework, that can be salvaged. That does not last forever.
Right.
And, you know, the question of the timelessness that often infects people, that really is what has to be addressed.
Well, that gets us to the second point that we were talking about at the very beginning, which is that our enemies are not just sitting still. They're not just counting on stopping Glass-Steagall. That's what the Schellenhuber WGBU report is about.
Absolutely.
They're preparing to dismantle what's left of the nation state and put it under a global eco-fascist dictatorship. What do you think is going to be the effect of this in the Congress? I know Mrs. LaRouche and our organization in Germany is on a crash mobilization right now to, in a rear guard effort really, to stop the Merkel government from shutting down nuclear power, coal power, oil power, virtually everything. What do we have to do in this country to make it clear to people that this is existential?
Well, you know, I think that the role of the LaRouche PAC site, the role of the candidates is critical in this. But I think we also have to understand that you know, whether or not members of Congress understand that this can be brought to a grinding halt without Glass-Steagall, to me, is secondary. The main thing is that we know it's the case. And therefore, if we move quickly on something that they do understand, then the fact of the matter is that by doing the obvious, which is imposing Glass-Steagall in the right. United States, mm-hmm. you deal with that problem in Europe. And look, for our population and for the people that represent them, I think that we have to start being a lot tougher on ourselves.
Right.
Because, you know, if somebody is a victim of rape once, they deserve, you know, tremendous support and compassion to get through, you know, a terrible, violent experience and a traumatic one. However, if that same person keeps going back to the same place and is raped repeatedly, at a certain point, you have to say, hello, what's wrong with you, my friend? You know, they are no, the person is no longer a victim, but somebody who's inviting it and asking for it. And that is essentially what has to be conveyed to our population. They have to stop operating like victims. You know, the Tea Party was an interesting phenomenon. People were angry and they were out there, but they also were co-opted.
Yeah, they went from the bailout and the health care bill into a whole slew of Republican issues taken over by Heritage Foundation, Dick Armey, and this crowd.
But it was easy because the people were somewhat lazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the difference, and I think it's why you get such, why the LaRouche candidates get such a tremendous response, is because on the one hand, they don't try to put a lid on the anger. They're angry. And they don't pull any punches in identifying who the enemy is and what the nature of the crisis is. But they don't stop there. They actually then can step forward and give people a view and an image of the potential of the future. They actually have a positive proposal to put forward. Because the fact is that, you know, the sentiment that produced the Tea Party, the phenomena that we refer to as the mass strike. Mass strikes bring governments down. They don't create government.
Right, right.
And we're in the business of creating government. We're in the business of creating policy. But people have to start acting like citizens.
Well, I hope our listeners are listening to this because I'm getting a couple of emails where people are saying, no, we have to go to the media. We have to, you know, I think the point that Mr. LaRouche has been making and that you are making very firmly today is we cannot allow ourselves to be distracted and going off in the side issues and looking for an easy way to do it. This question you just posed of citizens becoming citizens, taking the responsibility for the future, and that's what the LaRouche candidates are doing. So if you want to reiterate that again, it's Glass-Steagall, 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 right?
That's right. It is, and it is really, it is the solution. You know, we had a long discussion with Lynn before he went back to Europe, and one of the things that we discussed is that a lot of the people on Capitol Hill don't really understand the principle behind Glass-Steagall. And his response was, so what? So what? He said, look, they're not, you know, we'll educate, let them pass it. If they pass it, when you see it in practice, you see it at work, you'll get it. You'll then understand the principle. You know, it's like people who try to understand geometry and are completely baffled by it. But then when they start doing constructions, suddenly it all becomes clear. And that's the way this thing is going to work. But we've got to be very straightforward. No excuses. People have to mobilize, and they have to stay mobilized. It's not enough
right.
to get a response. You've got to keep going back and not stop until this is done.
And go
and
back
also,
with more people. Go back.
That's right.
Yeah, and
you have to go back with more people each time But also, you have to understand, look, this entire thing is being driven by us. You would not have even a Glass-Steagall bill in Congress were it not for what the LaRouche movement did. And therefore, it is people's obligation. And I know the people who are probably listening to us now are people who have extended themselves and have given generously. And that is, it's good, and believe me, it is deeply appreciated, but it's not enough. You just have to keep, you know, digging down, you know, into your pockets and mobilizing your friends and neighbors, because we do this on a dime, but you still need that dime.
I'll give you a perfect example of that. This morning we have a team out in California they've been invited to speak on Glass-Steagall at the California State University Student Senate Association, which we've addressed before. And they're going to decide today whether or not to endorse a Glass-Steagall resolution. And we're, of course, going to tell them that's not enough. You have to have teach-ins on every campus, get every student activated, and so on. We didn't have enough money to put gas in the car to drive from Los Angeles to San Luis Obispo this morning. And so we managed to do it. We can be resourceful, and we'll stretch the money better than anyone else. We'll get more bang for the buck. But the problem that Debbie's bringing up is absolutely critical. This is not just something that Lyndon LaRouche wants to do. This is your future, your children's future, your grandchildren's future. And if we don't get it, you're going to get these crazies who are literally Hitler-type fundamentalists pushing this environmentalist, eco-fascist dictatorship, which is the next phase when this empire collapses. So we've got to bring the empire to an end in a controlled and organized way and bring it back to Glass-Steagall. Now, Debbie, the last thing I'd like to just throw out, where do we stand in terms of the potential to, I'm not talking about 2012, I'm talking about immediately, to see this kind of mass strike again ignite and move people in the Congress. The Congress, coming back from the recess, as you said, was very attentive to what they found in the districts, were they not?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean,
there's a lot of discussion about that back in Washington.
Oh, yeah. They got creamed in their districts. And then even among guys who, you know, everybody kind of got the same treatment, but then you also did have, look, for, you know, we're all very hard on these guys in Washington, and it's not that they don't deserve it, because they sure as hell do. But, you know, a lot of them really do have, you know, sometimes they have trouble remembering, but they started out at this game because of some commitment to public service. And therefore, you know, if you're from the Carolinas or you're from Arkansas and you see an entire community wiped out, you have to really be a cold-hearted bastard to not respond to that. So it's reality also that is driving some of this. They can't turn their backs on people who they know, who they, you know, they have to see them. They grew up with them in many cases. Mm-hmm. So the assertion of that reality is there. And look, people should stop worrying about what the press says, or even among full-time LaRouche PAC organizers, people always say, well, what's the inside story? What's really going on? You want an inside story, go see a proctologist. This is not some secret behind-the-scenes conspiracy. This is out there, folks. Our country is falling apart. We don't have the money to pay for anything. You have states that are literally, they are shutting down elements of service that people never imagined could possibly happen in the United States. And all the cuts in the world aren't helping things. I mean, this is precisely what could lead to a total blowout in Europe this weekend or next. They push these bailout schemes on countries like Greece and Portugal and demanded brutal, murderous austerity. But even when they extract that promise At the end of the day, the deal falls apart because they don't even have the money to do that.
Yeah.
That's where we're at. That's reality. That's what people have to operate off of. And just block out all the background noise and stop coming up with excuses as to why you don't think something will work. Trust me, if you follow Mr. LaRouche's lead, it will work. But you've got to do the work.
Debbie, we've run out of time, but I think we can say again, Glass-Steagall, and don't stop till we get Glass-Steagall.
Absolutely.
Thank you for being with us today, Debbie, and we'll bring you back as soon as we get Glass-Steagall to talk about where we go from there.
Well, then it should be very soon.
I hope so. And in the meantime, go to the LaRouchePact.com website, get the facts, get the material you need, and thank you for listening today. We'll be back next Saturday for another edition of the LaRouche Show.